I mean that there are a whole lot of people that I wouldn't mind seeing drowned. Really. I think that we should go for it. Kay looked up at him. He didn't look particularly fazed by what he had just proposed. No way, she said. Corny shrugged. Janet's boyfriend, for example. What a prick. Kenny? Kay squeaked. Look, it doesn't have to be him. I could think of a dozen people. The best thing is that they're all so dumb, I'm sure I would have no problem convincing them to come down here and ride the horse. I'm thinking that stupidity should have consequences. Come on, we can do a little weeding of the human race. He waggled his eyebrows. No, she said. Think of something other than people we can give it. Oats, he said vaguely. A huge box of instant oatmeal. A subscription to Equestrian's Digest. Hay and lots of it. We're not getting people killed, so just give it up, okay? She was getting sick of listening to Corny's sighs. She bet that Reuben's name would be a fair price. After all, this thing was probably not part of any court, being tied to the stream here. She bet that he would be counted as a fair price indeed, and it wouldn't change the fact that she knew the name, too. It would be a fine revenge on him for killing Gristle. But then, she imagined that the Kelpie would just order him to bring people for it to drown, and he would do it. What else was there to bargain with that a Kelpie might like? She thought about the dolls in her room, but all she could picture was a little girl following a trail of them to the shore of the stream. Ditto with any musical instrument. She had to think about something that the Kelpie could enjoy alone. Clothing? Food? Then she thought of it. A companion. A companion that it could never drown. Something that it could talk to and admire. The merry-go-round horse. Oh, Corny, Kay said. I know just the thing. Getting back in the car was the last thing that Kay wanted to do, but she did, sliding into the back seat, pressing her shirt over her mouth as though the fabric could filter the iron out of the air.
You know where you're going, right?
She asked, wondering if he could understand the words, muffled as they were by the cloth.
Yeah.
She let her head slide down to the plastic seat. One wing twitched just out of her vision, sending scattered luminescent rainbows through the thin membrane to dance on her leg under each passed light. Everything narrowed to those rainbows. There was no Corny in the front seat, no scratchy radio song, no passing cars, no houses, no malls, no real things to protect her from the glittering patterns on her grass-green thighs. There were no words for what she felt, no sounds, nothing. There was no word for what she was. No explanation that would keep back the numb, dumb, dark. She felt the dizziness threaten to overwhelm her.
Can you please open your window?
She asked.
I can't breathe.
What's wrong with yours? She crouched down the edge of the seat and reached her hands into the front of the car, palms up like a supplicant.
Every time I touch the handle, it burns. Look.
She held her hand out to him, and he could see that part of it was flushed. Her fingers wiggled.
That's from the door handle.
Shit. Corny took a breath, but he could not seem to let it go. He rolled down his window. The salt in the air cleaned her throat with each lungful from the open window, but it wasn't enough to battle the rising nausea.
I have to get out of this car.
We're almost there. Corny stopped at the red light. Corny parked the car outside the big building. It was strange to see it in the daytime. The overcast sky made the outside of the building look even dingier.
Are you okay?
Corny asked, and turned his head to see her in the back seat. Kay shook her head. She was going to vomit, right there, right on top of the empty soda cans and mashed fast food boxes. She put her hand in the pocket of the sweatshirt and opened the door.
Kay, what are you doing?
Kay half fell, half crawled onto the asphalt of the parking lot and dragged herself to the edge of the grass before she started vomiting. There was little in her stomach, and most of what she coughed up was stomach acid and spittle.
Jesus!
Corny crouched down next to her.
I'm okay,
Kay said, rising dizzily to her feet.
It's all the metal.
He nodded, looking back at the car and then looking around skeptically.
Maybe we should forget about this.
Kay took a deep breath.
No. Come on.
She ran around the back, following the path she had walked with Janet.
Give me your jacket, she said. There's glass.
Everything was different in daylight. Up the stairs, and there it was, dingier now that she got a good look at it, but still beautiful. The cream of its flanks was closer to a brown, and the gilt trim was mostly rubbed off. Its lips were carved in what she thought was a slight sneer, and Kay grinned to see it. Together, they dragged the horse over the floor toward the stairs. Leaning forward, the weight of it was resting on Corny as they eased it down step after step. It barely fit. Downstairs, Kay climbed out through the window as Corny pushed it carefully through. Outside, Corny started to panic. There was no way it was going to fit in the back of the car. Worse, the trunk was filled with boxes of used books and oddball tools.
Someone is going to see us. We've got to find a way to tie it to the roof. Fuck, fuck, fuck!
Corny dug around in the trunk of the car and came up with a single bungee cord, two plastic bags, and some twine.
That string is very thin, Kay said skeptically.
Corny twisted it around the wooden creature's neck and body, and then through the inside of the car.
Get on the other side. Someone's going to see us. Hurry!
He tossed her the twine, and she looped it over the horse and threw it back to him. Corny knotted it.
Okay, good enough. We gotta go.
Corny hopped in on his side, and Kay walked around and got in, wrapping Corny's jacket around her hand to close the door. He took off, stepping on the pedal so hard that the tires screeched as they pulled out. Kay was sure that each car that pulled up behind them was going to be a cop, or that the horse was going to fly off onto the road or hit another car, but they got back in one piece. Pulling over, they hauled the merry-go-round horse down into the forest and to the stream.
That thing better like this. I'm going to have splinters for a week.
It will.
And I'm going to have to pop the hood of the car back up in the center.
I know. I would help you if I could touch it, okay?
I'm just saying. That thing better like it.
It will.
They set the legless horse down on the muddy bank, angling it so that it sat relatively upright without their holding it. Kay looked around for another leaf, and Corny took the knife out of his pocket without being asked.
It's okay. I'm just going to pick the scab.
He made a face but didn't say anything.
Kelpie,
Kay said, dropping the leaf into the water.
I have something I think you might like.
The horse rose up from the deep and stared at the crippled merry-go-round horse. Whinnying, it clopped up onto the shore.
It has no legs, the Kelpie said.
It's beautiful anyway, Kay said.
The Kelpie circled the wooden thing, snuffling appraisingly.
More, I think. Crippled things are always more beautiful. It's the flaw that brings out beauty.
Kay grinned. She'd done it. She'd actually done it.
So you'll teach me?
The creature looked at Kay and shifted, and where it had been now stood a young man, nude and still dripping, hair tangled with rushes. It looked from Kay to Corny.
She I will teach, but you must make it worth my while if you want me to teach you too. Come and sit near me.
Nothing's worth that, Kay said.
The Kelpie man smiled, but his eyes were on Corny as he traced a pattern on his chest. Corny's breathing went shallow.
No,
Corny said, so softly that it was hard to hear his voice. Then the creature transformed again, sinuous energy coiling until Kay was looking at herself.
Are you ready to begin, then?
The Kelpie said in Kay's voice with Kay's mouth, and then the smile, not at all Kay's, curled slyly.
I have much to teach you, and the boy would do well to listen.
Magic is not the sole province of the Fae.
I thought you said he had to make it worth your while.
His fear is worth something for now. I am allowed so little consolation.
The Kelpie looked at her with her own black eyes, and she watched those lips, so like her own, whisper,
"So long since I have known what it was to hunt."
"How come?" Kay asked, despite herself.
"We, who are not the rulers, we must obey those that are. Mortals are a treat for the gentry, and not for the likes of you and me. Unless, of course, they are willing."
Kay nodded, pondering that.
"Do you know how it feels to build magical energy?" the Kelpie asked. "It is a prickling feeling. Cup your hand and concentrate on building the energy in it. What does it feel like?"
Kay cupped her hand and imagined the air in her hand thickening and shimmering with energy. After a moment, she looked up in surprise.
"It feels like when your hand falls asleep and then you move it. Prickly, like you said, like little shocks of energy shooting through it. It hurts a little."
"Move it back and forth between your hands. There you feel magic in its raw state, ready to become whatever you want it to be."
Kay nodded, cradling the energy that was like a handful of nettles, letting some of it trickle through her open fingers. It was a feeling she remembered, sometimes coiling in her gut or pricking over her lips before some strange thing happened.
"Now, how did you accomplish raising the energy? What did you do?"
Kay shook her head slightly. "I don't know. I just pictured it and stared at my hand."
"You pictured it. That is the easiest of the senses. Now you must learn to hear it, to smell it, to taste it. Only then will your magic become real. And be careful. Sometimes a simple glamour can be seen through out of the corner of another's eye."
The creature winked. Kay nodded.
"When you do magic, there are two stages. Focus and surrender. Surrender is the part that so many do not understand. To do magic, you must focus on what it is you want to do, then let go of the energy and trust it to do your bidding. Close your eyes. Now picture the energy surrounding you. Imagine, for example, a ring on one of your fingers. Add detail to it. Imagine the gold of the band. Then imagine the gem. Its color, its clarity, how it will reflect the light. That's right. Exactly like that."
Her eyes fluttered open as Corny gasped.
"Kay, there really is a ring on your finger. A real, imaginary ring. I can see it."
Kay opened her eyes, and there it was. On her index finger, just as she had imagined it, the silver carved into the shape of a girl and the glittering emerald set in her open mouth. She turned it against the light. But even knowing that she had magicked it into being, the ring was as solid as a stone.
"What about undoing things?" Kay asked.
The Kelpie threw back its head and laughed, white teeth shining even in the gloom.
"What have you done?"
"Enchanted someone to like me," Kay said in a low voice. Corny looked at her, surprised and a little annoyed. He wasn't going to be happy that there was another part of the story she'd left out. The Kelpie grinned and clucked its tongue.
"You must remove the enchantment on him in the same way that you would take off a glamour. Feel the web of your magic. Reach out and tear it. Practice with the ring."
Kay concentrated, letting the energy swirl around her, feeling it run through her. It seemed to ebb and flow with each beat of her heart. They were driving back when Kay pointed to the hill.
Look at those lights. Wonder who's up there.
I don't see anything.
He looked at her sharply in the rearview mirror. Cemetery Hill was a large sloping hill with a steep incline on the side that faced the highway. That side had neither graves nor tombs, and in the winter kids would blithely go sledding, piling spare mittens and scarves on the monuments. An abandoned, half-built mausoleum stood at the base of one gently sloping side. With two levels but no roof, the top was overgrown with smallish trees and vines. There were dozens upon dozens of monuments, tombs, and gravestones erected around it.
"Think that's where the Unseelie Court is?" she asked softly.
"I want to see it." He drove into the graveyard. They parked along the tumbled stone path. She stared through the rear windshield at the darting lights as she waited for Corny to walk around and open her door.
"Those are definitely fairies," Kay said.
"I can't see anything."
There was an edge of panic in Corny's voice.
Kay followed the lights, saw them dazzle and turn, keeping just enough ahead of her that she could not see them clearly. She sped up her pace, boots crunching the frost-stiffened grass. They were so close she could just snatch one out of the air.
"Kay!" Corny called, and she turned. "Don't fucking leave me behind and make me have to wonder if I'm a goddamn nutcase for the rest of my life."
"I'm not leaving you. I'm trying to catch one of these things." Suddenly there was an impossible explosion of fireflies darting in and out of the trees. It must be well past midnight and too late in the season for fireflies anyway, the chill of autumn and recent rain stiffening the grass beneath their feet with frost. But the insects darted around them, each blinking for a long moment, then gone, then blinking again. Then she looked at them carefully. They were little winged creatures, even smaller than those she had snatched at. One flitted close to her and showed its teeth. Kay made a shrill sound.
"What?" Corny said.
"Not bugs. They're tiny, nasty fairies." He dropped Kay's hand and snatched at one, although it darted out of his grip.
"I can't see anything. Are those the things, what you saw from the road?"
She shook her head. "No. Those lights were bigger." He squatted down, his breath rising from his lips in puffs of white vapor.
"Can you see them now?"
She shook her head.
"Ludi said something about the opening being in a brown patch of grass, but practically the whole hill is covered with brown grass.
Maybe the patch is bare by now." Kay knelt down next to Corny and cupped her ear to the ground. There was faint music.
"Listen. You can hear it."
He moved to her side and pressed his ear to the ground as well.
"Music," he said. "Sounds like pipes."
"It's beautiful," she said, the smile on her face before she remembered that this was not a good place they were trying to enter.
"Let's walk a circuit around the hill. We'll both look for any patch that seems weird."
Corny stretched from his squat and waited for her to start walking. The graveyard was unnaturally quiet. The moon was, if anything, fuller and fatter than it had been when she last saw it. It seemed unnatural. The thing looked bloated in the sky, and she thought again about the sun bleeding to death while the moon grew tumescent with devoured light. The newer, granite gravestones were all polished to an unnatural mirror shine that reflected her and Corny as they passed. The older markers were a pale, milky marble, grass stains and dirt washed out by the moonlight, pale as Reuben's hair.
"Hey, what about that?"
Corny pointed to a patch of grass that did seem a different shade of brown. Kneeling down beside it, Corny pulled back a corner as though it were the flap of a sod tent. Corny leaned in.
"No," Kay said. "I have to go in there alone."
"I want this," Corny said.
"You said you wouldn't leave me behind."
"It's probably not safe for me to go. I'll be back as soon as I can." Kay shimmied into the entrance.
"I promise."
The music seemed louder now, pipes and laughter swelling in the quiet night. Kay heard Corny say, "You get to have all the fun," as she followed the song inside. 7.
listening to the prisoned cricket shake its terrible dissembling music in the granite hill. Louise Bogan, Men Loved Wholly Beyond Wisdom. She slipped inside the hollow hill. The air itself seemed thick with sweetness, and breathing was disorienting. Long, low tables were heaped with golden pears, chestnuts, bowls of bread soaking in buttery milk, pomegranates ripped in half and half again, violet petals on crystal plates, and all manner of strange delicacies. Wide silver goblets sat like toads on the tables, upright and overturned in equal proportion. Scarlet-clad fairy ladies brushed past men in torn rags, and courtiers danced with crones. Revelers danced and sang, drank and swooned. The costumes were more like some demented, organic couture. Collars rose like great fins. Outfits were composed entirely of petals or leaves. Ragged edges finished off lovely dresses. Ugly, strange, or lovely as the moon, none were plain.
"The Unseelie Court," she said aloud.
She had expected something else, a cave, maybe, filled with gnawed human bones and fairy prisoners. Something simple. Looking out into the throng of revelers, she didn't know what to think. The room itself was massive, so large that she wasn't sure what was on the other side. Far across the room, what looked like a giant slouched near a dais. Each step seemed to push her in a new direction, full of splendors. A fiddler was playing an improbable instrument, with several necks and so many strings that he sawed his bow at them wildly. A long-nosed woman with freckles and ears like a jackal's juggled pine cones. Three men with red hair and double rows of shark teeth dipped their caps in a pile of carnage, soaking up the blood. A huge creature with bat wings and limbs like stilts sat atop a table and lapped at a beaten copper bowl of cream. It hissed at Kay as she passed it. Above them all, the domed ceiling was frescoed with dangling roots. Kay picked up a goblet off a table. It was ornate and very heavy, but it seemed clean. She poured a thin, reddish liquid from the silver carafe in the center of the table. Small seeds floated at the top, but the drink smelled pleasant and not entirely strange, so she took a swallow of it. It was both sweet and bitter, and went to her head so that, for a moment, she was obliged to hold the table for support. She took a silvery apple from a pile of strange, thorny fruit, turned it over in her hand, and gingerly bit into it. It was crimson on the inside and tasted like watery honey. It was so good that she ate it, core and all, till she was licking her hand for juice. The next was brown and rotten-looking as she bit into it, but the meat, though gritty, tasted of a fiery and sweet liquor. She felt an infectious giddiness come over her. Here, nothing she did was strange. She could twirl and dance and sing. All at once she was aware of how far into the crowd she had gone. She had been turned around so many times she no longer even knew which direction was the way back. She deliberately tried to retrace her steps. Three women walked past her, silver gowns trailing like fine mist. The low cut of the identical dresses showed off the women's hollow backs. She looked again, but their concave backs were as smooth and empty as bowls. She forced herself to keep moving. A short man, a dwarf, with intricate silver bracelets and shoulder-length black curls, leered at her as he bit into an apricot. Every moment became more unreal. A winged boy skipped up to her, grinning. "You smell like iron," he said, and reached out a finger to poke her side. Kay scuttled away from his hand to a chorus of laughter. Her eyes focused on the pale grasshopper green of the insect wings attached to the boy's back. She pushed through the crowd, weaving past dancers leaping in complex intertwining circles, past a clawed hand that snatched at her ankle from beneath the heavy scarlet cloth on one of the tables, past what looked like a debauched living chess game. A satyr with a curly beard and ivory horns was hunched over,
carefully ripping the wing off a small fairy trapped in his meaty fist. The thing screeched, beating its other wing hummingbird swift against the fingers that held it. Pale green blood dribbled over the goat man's hand. Kay stopped, stunned and sickened to watch as the satyr tossed the little creature in the air. It flew in desperate circles, spiraling to the earthen floor. Before Kay could step close and snatch it, the man's boot stamped down, smearing the fairy into the dust. Kay reeled back, pushing folk aside in her haste to get away. Angling through the multitudes, she thought of her own foolishness in coming here. This was the Unseelie court. This was the worst of fairyland come to drink themselves sick. Three men in shimmering green coattails, their arms and legs long and skinny as broomsticks, were pushing a doe-eyed boy with grasshopper legs between them. He crouched warily, as if to spring, but each time was unprepared for a sudden grab or push. "Let him alone," Kay said, stepping up to them. The boy reminded her too much of Gristle for her to just watch. The men turned to look at her, all of them identical. The boy tried to slip between them, but one of the skinny men locked his arm around the boy's neck. "What's this?" a skinny man asked. "I'll trade you something for him," Kay said, scrambling for a plan. One of the men snickered, and the other drew a little knife with an ivory handle and a metal blade that stank of pure iron. The third threaded his hand through the boy's hair, tipping his head back. "No!" Kay yelled as the iron dagger stabbed into the boy's left eye. The orb popped like a grape, clear liquid and blood running down his face as he screamed. The flesh hissed where the iron touched it. "So much better with an audience," one of the skinny men said. Kay stumbled back, reaching around on a nearby table, finding only a goblet. She hefted it like a small club, unsure of what she was going to do with it. One skinny man drew the iron blade over the skin of the boy's cheek, down his neck, as the boy trembled and squealed, his one good eye rolling weakly in his head. The iron left a thin red line where it passed, the skin bubbling to white welts. "Going to save him, puppet?" another of the skinny men called to Kay. Kay's hands were shaking, and the cup seemed nothing more than a heavy thing she held. Certainly it was no weapon. "We're not going to kill him," the man who was holding the boy's hair said. "Just softening him up a bit," the one with the knife put in. Fury surged up in her. The cup flew from her hand, hitting the shoulder of the man with the knife, spotting his coat with droplets of the wine before falling ineffectually to the dirt floor, where it rolled in helpless circles. One of the men laughed, and another lunged for her. She ducked into the crowd, pushing aside a dainty woman and sidling through. Then she came to a sudden halt. Half hidden by three toad-skinned creatures hunched over a game of dice, there was Corny. He was wedged against an overturned table, a goblet tipped in his hand. He was rocking back and forth with his eyes shut. A puddle of wine was soaking his pants, but he didn't seem to care. Revelers were packed in tightly around her, so she scuttled under the table. "Corny," Kay said, breathing hard. Corny was right in front of her, but didn't seem to see her. She shook him. He noticed that and finally glanced up. He looked drunk, or worse than drunk. Like he'd been drunk for years.
"I know you," Corny said thickly.
"It's me, Kay."
"Kay,
what are you doing here?"
"They said it wasn't for me."
"What wasn't for you?"
The hand with the goblet in it stirred slightly.
"The wine?"
"Not for me. So I drink it. I want everything that's not for me."
"What happened to you?"
"This," he said,
and twitched his mouth into something that might have been a smile.
"I saw him."
She looked quickly back into the throng.
"Who?"
Corny pointed toward a raised dais where tall, pale fairies spoke together and drank from silver cups.
Your boy, Robin of the White Hair. At least I think it was.
What was he doing?
Corny shook his head. It hung limply from his neck.
Are you going to be sick? She said.
He looked up into her face and smiled.
I am sick.
He began singing King of Pain, softly and off-key. His eyes focused on nothing, and he was smiling a little, one of his hands toying idly with a button on his shirt. It seemed as though he was trying to rebutton it.
There's the king on a throne, with his eyes torn out. There's a blind man looking for a shadow of doubt. Whoa, King of Pain, I'll always be King of Pain.
I'm going to find him, Kay said. She looked at Corny, who was still muttering, wiping the inside of his goblet with a finger that he brought to his lips.
Wait for me here, okay? Don't go anywhere.
He didn't make any reply, but she doubted that he could stand anyway. He looked well and truly wasted. Kay re-entered the throng, weaving toward where Corny had pointed. A woman with thick braids of crimson hair sat on a tall wooden throne with edges that came to worn peaks and spires. It was wormed through with termite holes, giving it the appearance of a lattice. At her feet, goblins gamboled. Reuben walked up to the throne and went down to one knee. Kay had to get closer. She couldn't see. Then she noticed there was a small indentation in the wall where she could hide herself, close enough to observe what was going to happen. She would watch, and she would find a way to make him sorry for what he had done. Rath Reuben Rye walked through the crowd, past a table where a sprite was squirming in an ogre's embrace, perhaps with pleasure, perhaps in dread. His old self would have stopped, surely. His silver blade was at his hip, but his lady awaited him, and he had learned to be a good little slave, and so he passed on. Lady Nicknevin, queen of the Unseelie Court, stood with her courtiers gathered around her. Claret hair blew around a white face inset with sapphire eyes, and he found himself halted once again by her cold beauty. Four goblins frolicked at her side. One tugged at her skirts like a toddler. Rath Reuben Rye dropped to his knees and bent his head so that his pewter hair puddled on the ground. He kissed the earth in front of her. He didn't want to be here tonight. His chest still ached, and he wanted nothing more than to lie down and close his eyes. But when he did close his eyes, all he saw was the human girl's face, full of shock and horror as he threw her down on the dirty floor of a diner. "You may rise," the lady said. "Approach me. I have a task to set you to." "I am yours," Rath Reuben Rye said, brushing the soil from his lips. She smiled a little smile. "Are you? And do you serve me as well as you served my sister?" He hesitated before answering. "Better, perhaps, for you try me harder." The smile curled off her mouth. "You would jibe with me?" "Your pardon, lady, I mean no scorn. It is seldom merry work you set me to." She laughed at that, silvery cold laughter that rose up out of her throat like crows going to wing. "You have no tongue for courtliness, knight. Yet I find you still please me. Why is that?" "Sport, lady," he ventured. Her eyes were hard and wet as blue beach glass, but her smile was beyond loveliness. "Certainly not wisdom. Rise. I understand that I have a mortal girl to thank for your presence here tonight." His face was grave as he stood. He made sure of that. It would not do to let his surprise show. "I was careless." "What a fine girl she must be. Do tell us about her."
A few of the unseelie gentry that attended her smiled openly, watching this game as eagerly as they would a duel. He was careful, so careful, to keep the flinch from his face. His voice had to be easy, his words could not seem to be carefully measured. She said that she was known to solitary fae. She had the sight, a clever girl, and a kind one. The lady smiled at that. Was it not the solitary fae that shot you, knight? He nodded and could not keep the ghost of a smile off his face. I suppose they are not all so closely allied, my lady. Oh, she didn't like that. He could tell. I have an idea, then, his lady said, raising one delicate finger to her smiling lips. Get us this girl. The tithe to the solitary fae will cement their loyalty. A young girl gifted with the second sight would be an excellent candidate.
No, he said.
It was a sharp bark, a command, and courtiers' heads turned at the sound. He felt the bile rise in the back of his throat. Not clever, that. He was not being clever. The Lady Nicknevin's smile bent her lips in triumph. I might point out that if they do know her, it will be just the thing to remind them not to break my toys, the lady said. She did not mention his outburst. There was a jibe in that meant for him, her toy, but he hardly heard it. He was already watching the girl die. Her lips were already cursing him with his true name. Let me find you another, he heard himself say. Once his lady might have found it amusing for him to struggle with that, finding an innocent to take the place of another innocent. I think not. Bring me the girl 2 days hence. Perhaps after I see her, I will reconsider. Naphamael has just come from my sister's court with a message. Perhaps he could be persuaded to assist you in finding her. His gaze flickered to the other knight, who appeared to be speaking to a goat-footed poetess and ignoring their conversation. It made Reuben queasy just to look at the iron circlet burning on his brow. It was said that even when he removed it, the searing scar ran deep and black in his flesh. He wore a cloak lined with thorns. What little revenge there was to be had on the Seelie court! Reuben had it in the form of Naphamael. He had noticed how often the Seelie queen sent her new knight back down to the Unseelie court on some easy task or another. Reuben bowed low enough for his knee and brow to touch the earth. But Nicknevin's attention was already elsewhere. He walked through the crowd, passing the table where he had seen the ogre. Nothing remained of the couple save 3 drops of cherry blood and the shimmery powder of the sprite's wings. His oaths cut him like fine wire. Kay watched Reuben sweep off the dais, fighting down the feelings that seemed to be clawing their way up her throat. A clever girl and a kind one. Those simple words had sped her heart in a way she didn't like at all. Did he know that his voice had softened when he'd spoken of her? He is so unpredictable that even his queen cannot trust him. He's as likely to be kind as to kill you. But the memory of his lips on her skin would not fade, even if she rubbed the spot, even if she scratched at it. Kay rose as another knight approached the queen and bowed low to press his lips to the hem of her dress. "Rise, Naphamael," the queen said. "I understand that you are here with a message for me." His slim figure rose with the same graceful, measured formality that Reuben had. This knight was wearing a band of metal on his brow. The skin around it was darkened, as though burned. There was something about his yellow eyes that Kay thought was familiar. "This is the message my lady would have you hear." His smile emphasized his implication of disloyalty. "My lady said,
that although there has been a truce in the matter of war, she wonders at the matter of mortal influence. She has some favorites that cross your borders and seeks a means of giving them safe passage through your lands. I am told to await your reply. She did not seem to think I need hurry back. I must confess that it is good to be home in time for the tithe. Is that all she said? Indeed, although one of the queen's courtiers begged me to ask after her brother, it seems that she hasn't had any news from him since he joined your court. A sweet thing, that girl. Very long white hair. One could almost wind a leash of it if one was so inclined. She looks very like the knight you just spoke with. Another mischievous smile. She wanted to know why you never use him as a messenger. The queen smiled too. It is good to have you home, Nephemael. Perhaps you can help my knight acquire our sacrifice. It would be my honor. In fact, I think I have heard of a very suitable candidate indeed. She's already acquainted with a member of your court. Kay was suddenly caught by the arm and turned. She yelped. You shouldn't be here. Reuben's tone was icy, and his hand was tight on her arm. Taking a breath, she met his eyes. I just wanted to hear the queen. If one of her other knights had noticed you spying here, they would have undoubtedly enjoyed making an example out of you. This is no game, Pixie. It is too dangerous for you to be here. Pixie? Then she remembered. He was seeing green skin, black eyes, folded wings. He didn't know her, or at least he didn't know that he knew her. She let go a breath she didn't even know she'd been holding. I'm no concern of yours, she said, twisting in his grip. Surely he would let her go, she told herself, but Spike's words echoed in her head. She saw Reuben on a black horse with glowing white eyes, face flecked with blood and dirt, eyes bright with frenzy, riding down poor Gristle as he hurtled through the brush. Indeed. He did not release his hold on her and was, in fact, pulling her through the crowd. From this vantage point, it was easy to see that people didn't just make way for him. They practically tripped over themselves to do so. I am Nick Nevin's sworn knight. Perhaps you should be more concerned about what I am going to do to you than what I might do for you. She shuddered. So what will you do? The knight sighed. Nothing, providing that you leave the brew immediately. Nothing? She was not sure what she expected to see in his face when she looked at him then, but it was not the weariness she saw there. No madness glittered in the depths of those pale eyes. But she couldn't leave, and she couldn't tell him that her very human friend was sleeping it off on the other side of the hill. She had to play this out. I'm not allowed here. It doesn't seem like there's a guest list. Reuben's eyes darkened at that, and his voice dropped very low. The Unseelie Court delights in guesting spies for the solitary fay. We so seldom have volunteers for our amusements. Dangerous ground now. The sadness was gone, and his features were carefully blank. Her stomach twisted. Delights? Our amusements? The implication of his participation was not lost on her. You can leave through here, he said, showing her an earthen tunnel that was not the one she had come through. This one was hidden by a chair and seemed closer to the giant. But you must do it quickly, now, before someone sees me speaking with you. Why? Kay asked. Because they might assume that I had taken a liking to you. Then they might assume that it would be amusing to see my face while I hurt you very badly. Reuben's tone was cold and flat. His words seemed to fall from his lips as though they meant nothing,
just words dropping into darkness. Her hands felt very cold as she remembered the diner. What would it be like to be a puppet? What would it be like to watch your own hands disobey you? Fury rose up in her like a dark cloud. She didn't want to understand how he could have killed Gristle. She didn't want to forgive him. And most of all, she didn't want to want him.
"Now, Pixie," he said. "Go."
"I don't know if I should believe you," she said. "Give me a kiss." If she couldn't stop thinking about his lips, maybe tasting them would get it out of her system. After all, if curiosity killed the cat, it was satisfaction that brought him back.
"There is no time for your snatched pixie pranks," he said.
"If you want me to leave quickly, you'd best be quick." She was surprised at her own words, wondering at the giddy viciousness of them. She was more amazed when his lips brushed across hers. A sudden shock of feeling lanced through her before he pulled away.
"Go,"
he said. But he said it in a whisper, as though she had drained the breath from him. His eyes were shadowed. Kay ducked through the tunnel before she was forced to think about just what she had done. And certainly before she had time to wonder how it had anything to do with revenge. Outside, it was cold and bright. It didn't seem possible, but the night was past. A breeze made the remaining leaves shudder on their branches, and Kay crossed her arms to seal in whatever warmth she could as she jogged across the hill. She knew where the brown patch of grass had been. It was simply a matter of getting inside again. If she just stuck to the wall, she thought, probably no one would notice her. Corny would be there, and this time, she would pay better attention. Mark the exit in some way. The grass was no browner in one place than another. She remembered the location well enough, next to the elm tree and by a grave marker that read, Adelaide. She dropped to her knees and dug, frantically clawing at the half-frozen topsoil. It was dirt and more dirt, hard-packed, as though there had never been a passageway to an underground palace.
"Corny!"
she shouted, well aware that he would not be able to hear her deep beneath the earth. 8. For beauty is nothing but the beginning of terror we can just barely endure, and we admire it so because it calmly disdains to destroy us. Rainer Maria Rilke, The First Elegy, Duino Elegies. Corny woke on the hillside to the sound of bells. He was shaking with cold. His teeth were chattering. His head felt thick and heavy, and just shifting his weight made his stomach lurch. His jacket was gone. He was lying alone on a hill in a graveyard, and he had no idea how he had come to be there. He saw his car, hazard lights still dimly flashing where he had pulled off alongside the road. A wave of dizziness hit him. He rolled weakly to one side and retched. The taste of the wine he vomited brought back a memory of a man's mouth on his, a man's hands stroking him. Shocked, he tried to form a face to go along with that mouth and those hands, but his head hurt too much to remember any more. He pulled himself to his feet, trying to keep his queasiness under control as he stumbled down the hill toward his car. Despite the lights being on all night, when he turned the key, the engine turned over and roared to life. Corny flicked the heater on full blast and sat there, basking in the gush of hot air. His body shuddered with pleasure. He knew that there was a bottle of aspirin under all the fast food wrappers and discarded novels. He couldn't make himself move. He leaned his head back and waited for the warmth that was creeping through his limbs to relax him and chase away the nausea. Then he remembered Kay in the back seat, and the beginning of the evening flooded back with disturbing intensity. Kay's skin, cracked and peeling, the first flutter of wet wings, her strange new self stretched out in the car, the music, then alone on the hillside, tangled memories tripping over one another. He had heard stories like this. Men and women waking on a hill, dreaming one night in Faerie. The hill never opened for them again. Angrily, he wondered if Kay was there still, dancing to distant flutes, forgetting that he'd ever tagged along. His stomach clenched as he thought of another explanation for being alone on the hill. It was a memory, really. Kay hunched over him, whispering, "I'm going to find him. Wait for me here." Because the more that he thought about it, the more he remembered the brutal parts. The distant scream he couldn't place, the sight of some of the revelers, teeth red with blood, and the man with the cloak of thorns who had found him sitting drunk in the dirt and... He shook his head. It was hard to remember the specifics, only that soft mouth and the scraping of those thorns. His hands fluttered to the sleeves of his shirt, rolling them back. Angry red wounds running up and down his arms were incontrovertible proof of how he'd spent the night. Just touching them filled him with a longing so intense it made him sick. Kay stumbled in the back door. A quick look at the red digital numbers on the microwave told her that it was late morning. Exhaustion settled over her as she strained to sense the wend and weft of magic in her fingers. She felt like a too taut piece of string, fraying as it was pulled. She'd looked and looked, but there was no way back into the hill. Perhaps it opened only at dusk. She'd have to go back tonight, retrace the same path, and wait. Her senses were over-acute. The flimsy glamour she was wearing now was nothing like the one she had before. She could still feel the slight rustle of wings against her back, still smell the trash under the sink, even separate out smells. Coffee grounds, eggshells, a bit of moldy cheese, detergents, some thick, syrupy poison used to bait roach traps. The air thrummed with energy she had previously ignored. If she opened up to it, she might be able to leave her fatigue behind. But she didn't want to. She wanted to cling to the facade of humanity with both fists.
"Kay, is that you?"
Kay's grandmother came in from the other room. She was wearing a robe and slippers, her thin gray hair pinned up in curlers.
"Did you just get in?"
"Hi, Graham,"
Kay said, yawning. She went over to the kitchen table, shifted a pile of newspapers and circulars out of her way, and put her head down in her hands. It was almost a relief to just let her grandmother yell at her, as if everything could be normal again.
"I called the school this morning."
Kay forced herself not to groan.
"Did you know that you are not allowed to drop out of school without a parent's written permission? According to your transcripts, you haven't been in school since you were 14.
Kay shook her head.
"What does that mean? Was that a no?
"I know I haven't been in school," Kay said, disgusted at how childish her own voice sounded.
"Well, it's a good thing that you know, Missy, but I want to know what it is you have been doing. Where are you sneaking off to?"
"Nowhere," Kay said in a small voice. "I just didn't want you to know. I knew you'd be mad."
"Well, why didn't you hightail it back to school then? Do you want to be nothing your whole life?"
"I'll get my GED, Kay said.
"Your GED? Like a drug dealer? Like a pregnant teenager? Do you want to wind up trailer trash like your little friend?"
"Shut up!" Kay yelled, holding her head.
"You think you know everything about everything, don't you? You think that the world is so easy to understand. You don't know me at all. You don't know one single thing about me. How can you possibly know anything about Janet when you don't know anything about me?"
"I will not have you shouting at me in my own house. You and your mother are just the same. You think that it's enough to want things? You think that if you just want and want, then you're just going to magically get?" Magically. Kay felt her face twist with an expression somewhere between a wince and a smirk.
"Nothing but hard work gets anyone anywhere. Even then,
People don't get what they want. People just suffer, and no one knows why they suffer. Talented people, like your mother, they don't make it, despite the talent. And what are you going to do then? You can't rely on luck. How do you know you're lucky? Kay was surprised to hear that her grandmother thought that her mother had talent. I'm not relying on luck, Kay said numbly.
Oh, really? What are you doing, then?
I don't know, Kay said. She was tired, and she could feel a whine creep into her voice. She was afraid that she was going to cry, and if she started crying right now, she wasn't sure she could stop. Worse, she knew she sounded petulant, upset only that she was caught. It wasn't far from the truth.
We needed the money.
Her grandmother looked at her in horror.
What money?
Is that what you think? Don't even talk to me, Kay said, burrowing her face in her folded arms. She mumbled into her own skin.
I was working at a fucking Chinese restaurant.